Session number 10152, Reel 2.
Group Captain Kingham, Reel 2.
Most of you, I suppose the fighting took place between Maidstone and Dover. Excuse me, I do beg your pardon about the coffee. But this was when one had any time to plan. Of course, you didn't always have time to plan, because sometimes you were sent off late because maybe you had only landed a short time ago from another sortie and hadn't had time to rearm and refuel. It was when you were sent off in time that you could do what I was describing before, climb to your height ahead of the enemy bombers, then turn around and attack them head on. Quite often, you didn't have time to plan, you just took off, you hit them wherever you could. And those occasions, usually it was closer to London, and sometimes over London. But normally speaking, one was able to intercept sort of halfway between the coast and London. And usually the bombers would turn back, you know, head-on attack, did far more to destroy the morale of the approaching bombers than anything else. And it upset the driver so much, the poor old pilot. He was a chap who then turned tail. When he was sitting and couldn't see the attack and was protected by a nice sheet of metal behind him, and he had gunners and he could hear the guns going backwards and all that, he was in a much more relaxed frame of mind than when it was coming straight at him and he had nothing between himself and the guns.
So it was a psychological as well as a physical combat.
Yes, absolutely.
What about the experience of your own particular squadron? How experienced were your pilots?
Well, as experienced as most people. We didn't have the experience of France. Some of the squadrons in the BOB had been in France. Some of the pilots had been transferred from squadrons that had been in France to squadrons that hadn't, so you got the odd pilot with some experience. But mostly, I suppose I was experienced, I was a fairly sort of typical example. A few hours over Dunkirk, a lot of hours doing bugger all, the part of the phony war, except for the Battle of Barking Creek, which I'm sure you'll have heard of. And you very rapidly built up your experience. I was acting CO of the squadron, of the 92 squadron for approximately 6 weeks, because I was shot down on the 15th of October, which is about 6 weeks after we'd been there. And let's carry on.
We were talking about the experience of your pilots.
Yes. As I was saying, I was perhaps a fairly typical example. But I think you learnt very quickly. As I said earlier on, it wasn't necessarily the number of hours you'd spent in the air. It was the number of hours you'd actually spent in combat. And if you lived the first three or four or five or six sorties, you cottoned on very quickly. And you learnt the business of rubbernecking, because far more pilots were shot down by an aircraft they never saw than by one they actually did see. People creeping up on you because you weren't looking around. In fact, that was how I finally bought it. Sheer overconfidence, being blasé, practicing a forced landing from 15,000 feet after an engagement, and never saw what shot me. But this was the experience that taught the hierarchy that the command of squadrons in the air should be given to people who built up operational experience, rather than people who built up many hours of peacetime flying.
Did you have the experience in your squadron of very raw pilots coming who hardly knew how to fly the plane?
Yes, we did, and our turnover was quite high. And the new young pilots that came in, some of them went on to be exceptionally successful. We had two I can think of right away, Neville Duke, who became chief test pilot for Hawkers, and Wimpy Wade. I don't know what his Christian name was, always known as Wimpy Wade, after the character in a cartoon in the Daily Sketch called Dagwood, I think it was. J. Wellington Wimpy. Anyhow, Wimpy Wade, in fact, became chief test pilot of Hawkers just before Neville. Neville, his assistant, then Wimpy got killed flying, and Neville took over. And they were both, Neville is still flying, and they were extremely successful, came in as 18-year-olds. And another young 18-year-old we had is still going strong, called Jeffrey Wellham, known as Boy Wellham. So if they lip, it's the same deal. If you lip the first few flights, you picked up the tricks.
But did you find that raw pilots were constantly being sent up on one mission and being shot down?
We did have a number which lasted for perhaps one or two or three missions and were shot down, yes. Missions, an American word, we used to call them sorties in those days. Funny how the Americanisms creep in, it's now radar instead of RDF.
How many sorties would you fly typically in a day during the battle?
I suppose anything between two or three or four.
And were you under much strain?
Not as much as the films would have you believe, especially American films, no. And you see, it's difficult to explain, but it wasn't known to be the Battle of Britain in those days. It was what everybody regarded as the way aerial war was going to be, and the way we all assumed it would be for the rest of the war. Nobody thought of it as a particular phase or gave it any particular significance. History called it the Battle of Britain afterwards, and I think, in fact, it was called that by Churchill as part of a recruiting drive more than anything else. But there was no sense of an occasion.
You weren't conscious of making history?
Not at all. There was no sense of an occasion at all. And it was part of the job. And it sounds awfully trite to say it was just my job. One is always hearing it. But we joined the Air Force because it was an exciting, fun life. And war developed. So what do you do? I mean, you can't suddenly say, well, I'm awfully sorry, I didn't really join the Air Force to fight a war. I just joined it for the fun flying in peacetime. It was very much a part of the job, and you were mentally attuned to it.
But did you feel that the question of whether or not the Germans would invade Britain or not depended on what you did?
I suppose that is true, that one did, and in fact one had to realise that there was an invasion pending. But equally one knew there wouldn't be one. I mean, I was quite convinced, and I think most fighter pilots were, that there's no way they could get through us. So there was no sort of nervousness in case the Germans landed or in case they invaded. I mean, if they did invade, we thought it was a marvellous opportunity to slaughter all these barges coming in.
And yet, in the air battles, were you not heavily outnumbered all the time?
Yes, I think we were. I'm always surprised at the number of aircraft which took part. One hears now that 460-something pilots were killed or whatever it was in the Battle of Britain. But the reason we were outnumbered, I suppose, was because the Germans came over in two or three waves a day, and each wave consisted of as many aircraft as they could get together. So it was a huge phalanx of bombers with several squadrons of fighters. And the RAF was split up amongst itself. Obviously, it had to cover quite a lot of territory. So at any one stage, a relatively small number of aircraft were attacking. I mean, when we attacked it, the bomber formation of 100 or 200 aircraft, there would probably only be the 8 of us, which was the average number of aircraft we fielded. A squadron should have been 12, but you usually got about 6 or 8 in the air because either you didn't have enough pilots or you hadn't, your aircraft had been damaged. So although the number of RAF pilots and aircraft was much greater than I'd ever realized, at no one point in time, at no one attack in time, did there ever seem to be anybody else except you and your squadron. You sometimes saw them in the distance when you were arriving or when you were leaving.
What did you personally think of the tactics which the Germans adopted?
Well, they didn't really adopt any tactics. They came in the only sort of formation those big bombers could adopt. They were layered. They weren't one behind the other. They were in layers, one above the other. Not individually. There were formations of 6 or 8 Vics or whatever it was. And there'd be 3 or 4 of those abreast of each other, and then a few feet above would be another layer and so on. So when you looked at them from ahead, it was a big box-like formation approaching you. And then above the box-like formation, which might be 4, 5, 6 layers of bombers, and above that would be 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 squadrons of, in those days, almost always yellow-nosed 109s, circling and waiting for you. They'd never had time to get to if you attack from head on before you managed to have at least one good solid go at the bombers.
Which German fighter did you particularly fear?
I don't think one feared any German fighter. Certainly in those days, the only German fighters there were the 109s. The 190 hadn't arrived. The 190, first time I saw 190s was over the Nieselau and Scharnhorst, which was the following year. But there were pros and cons for the German fighters. The 109 could outdive you and could outclimb you, and I think it was faster, straight and level. But it didn't have the maneuverability. And all in all, there's no Spitfire pilot who would have swapped for a 109. They had one advantage. They could, a Messerschmitt could push the nose forward and the engine wouldn't cut out. The Merlin engine, if you pushed the nose forward, the negative gravity on the carburetor pushed the float up and your engine cut. And the following year, they managed to begin a modification which overcame that. So if you wanted to dive quickly in a Spitfire, you had to get onto your back first and pull the stick back, and then roll back onto your front, if you see what I mean. You couldn't just dive from the straight and level position without your engine cutting and losing pick up again, of course, a few seconds later, but you'd lose valuable speed.
So you were saying that the different German fighters had different qualities?
Yes, but in the Battle of Britain, I don't think there are any other than the 109s. There might have been more than one Marker 109. And they've talked about the elite yellow nose 109s, but I don't think I ever saw a 109 that didn't have a yellow nose. I think it's their normal colour.
What was your attitude towards the enemy? Did you hate them? Or?
No, it was as I say, you had this sort of primeval, I suppose, urge to protect your own homeland, which is extraordinary, because I never thought I'd have that type of research and patriotism. But apart from that, no, because aerial warfare does have this clinical, abstract quality. As I said earlier, you're not fighting people, you're fighting machines. It's quite detached. And really, what's quite a shock when suddenly an aeroplane you'd be firing at would suddenly erupt bodies, and it would bring home to you with a bit of a shock that there are actually people in there that you were killing.
Did you hear of pilots parachuting who were shot at?
Yes. The Poles always used to shoot a pilot. Geneva Convention, for what it's worth, said you shouldn't shoot anybody over his own territory. Sorry, you're allowed to shoot him if he's landing over his own territory, but not if he was over yours. The idea was he'd be a prisoner of war and be hors de combat anyhow. But I know the Polish pilots who, as far as they were concerned, a German had to be killed, and they would just kill him. And I know one or two English pilots who did as well. I remember one telling me that he shot a chap coming down his parachute, and the weight of the bullets knocked him right round the parachute.
Spun him over.
But I couldn't do that myself, oddly enough, even on his own territory. This is the curious thing about aerial fighting. I would be no good as a soldier because I couldn't stick a bayonet in a man's stomach. I didn't think I could. Maybe in the heat of battle one could. But I would cheerfully fill him full of holes if he was sitting in an aeroplane. Because I wasn't thinking about him, I was thinking about that machine.
Did the Germans shoot at descending parachutes?
I'd heard occasions when they did, yes, but I never personally experienced it.
Could you describe in detail any incident that sticks out in your mind?
They were all very similar, you know. It's I remember being shot down, but even that is not all that particularly. It didn't seem all that particularly unusual. All part of the sort of rich fabric of life, as they say.
How did it exactly happen?
Well, I was an absolute idiot, of course. I'd been leading 92. We'd attacked the bomber formation over, almost right over Maidstone. We'd engaged over Maidstone. We'd done the usual thing. I used up all my ammunition. And it's a curious thing which other pilots will tell you. But quite sometimes you'd be, one moment you'd be in the middle of a wheeling mass of aircraft, everyone shooting at everybody else. And but seconds later, you'd look around and the sky would be empty. It's quite a curious phenomenon which other pilots will tell you. Where they went, nobody knows. And this happened to me on this occasion. I was about 20,000 feet. And suddenly the sky was empty and I had no more ammunition anyhow. And I saw Biggin Hill in the distance. And it was a beautiful, clear autumn day. It was October the 15th. It was round about the middle of the day. And I thought, now's the time to practice a forced landing. So I looked around, I saw nothing behind me except three Spitfires. So I throttled back, and I was gliding. And I was gliding gently down towards Biggin Hill, and I was thinking about the eggs and bacon I might get with the luck when we landed. And about, I don't know, somewhere between 15 and 20,000 feet, I suddenly had a rattle of bullets in the aircraft. And I looked round, and one went through my leg. And I looked round, and three Spitfires drew up alongside me and took one look at me and half rolled away. And whether they'd shot me or not in error, because that did happen, or whether they'd shot something off my tail, I don't know. So anyhow, they could shot away my controls. And so I bailed out. And also there's blood coming out of the top of my flying boot. So I thought I'd better get down in a hurry anyhow. And so I hopped over. I didn't hop over the side. I was going very fast. I'd only just throttled back for a few moments. I had my nose well down. I was still travelling fast enough that when I opened the canopy, the air sucked me out. I didn't have to push any stick forward. And fast enough for me to get two black eyes from the force of the slipstream. And I knew that when we come up through a broken cloud layer at about 3,500 feet. So I knew that if I'd laid my fall till I hit the clouds, I would have plenty of space below me. And because I was bleeding in my boot, I thought maybe I'd lost a blood vessel. So I waited till I hit the cloud level, pulled my ripcord, sailed gently down, landed on one leg in a ploughed field, which has given me a slip disc, which I still suffer from to this day. And saw a lot of farmers gathering underneath me with pitchforks. I was a bit nervous because there were many occasions when Spitfire pilots, and particularly Polish pilots with their funny accents, had been set upon by the locals who knew that if you were shot down, you had to be a German. And I was wearing a German Mae West, which I'd taken off a pilot I'd shot down from the south of Wales when we were down there. So here I was, dangling with the German Mae West and the people gathering underneath me. But as it happened, when I touched down, they were all extremely friendly because my Spitfire crashed just before me. And so they said, where would you like to go? And I said, well, what hospitals do you have around here? And they named a few, and one of them was one at Chatham, a naval hospital at Chatham. And I said, well, presumably the Navy should know more about bullet wounds than an ordinary civilian hospital, so I'll plump for Chatham. So I was taken to Chatham and wheeled into the operating theatre. And I came to, in my bed later on, the nursing theatre, a theatre sister sitting next to me. My leg was in plaster from ankle to hip and soaked in blood. And she said, I am glad you're back with us because I didn't think you were going to make it. And I said, well, what was wrong? It was one small bullet hole. She said, well, rather an old surgeon. And he didn't x-ray your leg before he searched for the bullet, which was still there. And in searching for it, he cut a blood vessel. And then in searching for the end of the blood vessel, which apparently, because they're elastic, disappear, he made this big wound in the back, couldn't find the blood vessel, stuffed the wound full of gauze, wrapped it very tightly in plaster of Paris, and hoped for the best. And as it happened, it did stop in time. So that was my experience of the Naval Hospital.
How long was it before you recovered?
Well, I was in the hospital not very long, about 3 weeks, and I went back during that time. And I flew once on crutches with the 92 squad, and I went back to Biggin Hill for a guest night. And Bob Tuck, as it happened, had come down to spend the day on a visit from his squadron from his Hurricane squadron in Norfolk. And I was hobbling around on my crutches, and he said, why don't we each borrow an aircraft and go up at 92 on the next sortie? So I said, what a good idea. So I borrowed an aircraft from Sergeant Folks, I remember, who got killed later on. And Bob Tuck borrowed an aircraft from somebody else. And off we went. And we did engage. I can't remember what happened. Then after that, I went. I was on sick leave 3 or 4 weeks, and I was posted back to 92 Squadron just after Christmas.
Was it possible to fly in a plane in that condition?
Yes. It was only my calf, you see, and with the rudder, you only use your thigh muscle, you don't need your calf.
During the Battle of Britain, did you get much support from the public, or were they unaware of you?
Well, one of the Yes, it was that one of the enjoyable things about being a fighter pilot really was this. It was the split existence one led in that one moment you were, you know, you're at Angels 1-5 or whatever the hell it was, with everybody shooting at you and you shooting at everybody else, and then an hour or two later you'd be in your local pub, boozing with the locals, who in fact would they regarded the whole thing really. I think they regarded the Battle of Britain as their own entertainment. I was told not very long ago about by a chap who in the Battle of Britain was a schoolboy, and how he and his brother went to a cinema one afternoon to watch some film like Errol Flynn and Hell's Angels or whatever it was, and they wondered whether they ought to go and see the film or whether they should sit outside and watch the Battle of Britain, except it wasn't called the Battle of Britain, they are fighting. And I think secretaries used to say to yourself, what are you doing for lunch, Mabel? Well, I think I'll go out into the park and watch the battle. And it was, I think, the reason really why the Battle of Britain, I'm quite sure, got all the publicity it did was because the public were keenly aware of it, because it was fought in their own backyard. And there were so many other people at the time who were living far more dangerously than we were, such as the oil tankers, for instance, and the people on the North Sea convoys, and the bomber pilots and the submariners, you name them, I mean, they were, and the undercover people in France. I mean, they were the people who really lived with danger. We took off from warm bases, we were fed well because we got extra eggs, etc. We flew in the best possible equipment. You never flew for more than an hour and a half, at the very most, you never flew more than two or three times a day. When you weren't flying, you were having a pint of beer with the locals. Admittedly, you got up extremely early, which I've never found enjoyable. I've never been an early riser, and one was out of bed at 3:30, so very often one didn't bother even to take one's clothes off in the evening, because one found one was partying most of the night away. So I would toss down in a chair, fully dressed, so that I didn't have too much trouble getting up in the morning. And the squadron doctor would come round dispersal every morning with his bucket of his patient hangover cure. And it was that sort of extraordinary dual existence one led.
You must have seen the films that have been made about the Battle of Britain since. Mm. Do you think they portray it accurately?
Well, I've only seen, I think the only one I've seen was called The Battle of Britain. And that, yes, it's difficult because it was all done by models, or most of it done by models. There's a certain unrealism about some of the sequences, and certain, some of them are done extremely well. But I haven't seen any other film on the Battle of Britain. Has there been one?
I think there have been several, but I saw one the other day on television. But do you think that it captured the atmosphere amongst the men accurately, amongst the pilots?
I can't honestly comment, because I don't think I've ever... I've only seen the one film that I can remember, and that was a long time ago. I think the answer probably is not. I'm reading a book at the moment called Piece of Cake, which I was sent by the author, and it's a splendid book, but I think he's done what most people do and tend to caricature. It's all very much pilot Pio Prune, all very much wacko chaps and Wizzo Prang type stuff, which was I think it has to be caricatured slightly.
But was that type of lingo used in actual practice much?
Well, when it's used now, it's used self-consciously. When it was used then, it was used as part of the language, and it somehow didn't jar because it wasn't used as aggressively as it is now. People now make a point of using it. So it comes out somehow now it's out of context, and then it wasn't.
You talked earlier about the advantages which Britain had in the Battle of Britain, but apart from what you said then about fighting over your own territory, why do you think the Battle of Britain was won?
Frankly, I am buggered if I know. I suppose it was because we didn't realise it was the Battle of Britain. Everybody thought that it was a normal part of the phase. Don't forget, there hadn't been a war for a year. There'd been this phony war where we'd sat around and done nothing except the Battle of Barking Creek was the action we had. And once it did start, finally, we thought, well, this is now, the war has now started, and we all assumed that it would be exactly the same for the duration. So I think nobody in Fighter Command would have given up. I mean, there's no question of ever giving up or ever in defeat. It sounds pompous now, but it wasn't a word one thought of. The context was wrong for it. I mean, it was simply a war, and you were fighting the war, and these bloody Germans over your country. And so there was no question ever of from our point of view, of relaxing the pressure. It would have gone on until they had been defeated. And the thought of defeat would never occur to anybody.
When was the Battle of Barking Creek?
It was something like the third Sunday of the war, and I know that I was at Hornchurch, and they dispersed us round the airfield in tents. The idea being quite rightly that try and get the pilots and the aircraft scattered as much as possible so that one bomb on one hangar doesn't kill a lot. And for the first, I think war was declared on a Friday, Thursday or a Friday, and a few days later, because nobody had been allowed to fly, everybody had been grounded, and we were all sitting around, you know, gossiping, talking, waiting for the drone of the bombers and the sound alarms and the scramble notice. And it didn't happen. And finally, aircraft needed to be flown because aircraft which were being repaired had to be test flown. And so a section in Fighter Command, I can't remember from where, was given, or one aircraft was given permission to take off for a test flight, which he duly did. It was then plotted as an unidentified aircraft, so a section of two or three aircraft was sent off to identify it. And they were then plotted as identified. Don't forget, this never happened before, so everybody's totally inexperienced. And then a flight was sent off, and then a squadron and so on, the whole thing built up, until virtually the whole of Fighter Command, or the whole of 11 Group, was airborne, chasing its own tail around the skies above Kent and Essex. And it was a sad end, because some Sailor Milan, who's one of the great pilots, and who was CO 74 Squadron, who was at Hornchurch at the time, and he was leading 74 Squadron, and they came across a flight of Hurricanes, and Sailor for a moment thought they were 109s, which of course on reflection they couldn't have been, because in those days the 109s were stationed hundreds of miles away, way out of range, because the continent hadn't been overrun. So he put his squadron into one of the Fighter Command attacks, pulled up beside them, realised they were Hurricanes, and broke away. And the chap leading his second section pulled up beside and thought, ha-ha, Sailor's missed, and opened fire before he suddenly realised himself they were Hurricanes, and shot down two Spitfires, or two Hurricanes rather, and one of them was killed. And that, unfortunately, was the end of the Battle of Barking Creek. But that was just an indication of, it was a learning curve, and everybody was at the very bottom of the learning curve at that stage, and particularly the controllers.
What part did you play in the battle?
We were airborne, and the whole of our squadron was airborne, and we were told to orbit around in the Thames over the Isle of Sheppey. And again, it's an interesting reflection on the times, because when they told us to orbit, half of our orbit took us over the Isle of Sheppey, and half into the Thames. I think we were about 10,000 feet, something of that sort. And every time we went over the Isle of Sheppey, all the local anti-aircraft opened fire at us. And as we got out into the Thames again, then they would stop. And as we went back again, they opened fire. But because we'd been told to orbit at that particular point, nobody thought of getting the hell out and orbiting a few miles off where we wouldn't get shot at. So we went on solemnly and religiously orbiting while the anti-aircraft were using us as target practice, until finally we landed. When we did land, our CO chap called, not the same fellow, called Saunders, not Sanders in 92, Saunders, who was CO of a